listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Station tours start at noon, and we are located on the second floor of the sub.
The wind blew some luck in my direction. I caught it in my hands today. I finally made a tricky French connection.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, October 5th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Morgan Yee. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:06 and time for another almost full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Today, we have a story from our new News 101 reporter, Najin Rizian, about an Engineers Without Borders fair at BCIT. We'll also be bringing you our regular segment, Simply Science and Dietetics Intuition.
All this, plus your weekend weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for our campus and local headlines.
Yesterday, beginning just before noon, over 500 QP Local 116 workers from UBC, as well as supporters from other unions, marched around the campus, ending in a rally at the North Plaza of the Student Union Building. More job action is expected to take place in the coming weeks. President of QP 116, Colleen Garb, said, quote, "This is the first day of our escalating job action. We need to wake up. First of all, we need to make some noise because I don't think they can hear us over in Victoria," end quote. Although QP 116 is employed by UBC, Garb explained that the provincial government has a lot of clout in determining whether an agreement is met or not. Garb also commented that the provincial government has recently considered privatizing service jobs across BC public universities. She says that QP unions across BC will not cease their job action until the province promises that no privatization will happen. QP 116 represents campus security, food services, tradespeople, custodians, and other support and service staff throughout UBC. Other QP unions representing staff at the University of Victoria, Simon Fraser University, Thompson Rivers University, and the University of Northern British Columbia are also taking part in the planned job action. Barry O'Neill, president of all QP unions in BC, attended the UBC strike and said, quote, "What the locals are asking for is a cost of living allowance, which doesn't seem very outrageous to me," end quote. Yesterday's job action had minimal impact on the daily activities of most students. However, as the job action ramps up, students are encouraged to make themselves aware of the situation and were told in an email sent to all students that, quote, "You are expected to come to campus and attempt to attend all scheduled classes, labs, and examinations. If, as a matter of conscience, you choose not to cross picket lines, you must inform the dean of the faculty in which you are registered that you intend to not cross picket lines by 11:45 a.m. on Tuesday, October 9th, 2012. You're responsible for learning any material you miss as a result of you not crossing a picket line," end quote. Students living in residence were also notified via email that the student housing and hospitality services will remain open, but with severely limited hours. The email said students should be careful to remember their keys as there may be several hour periods during which the front desks in common blocks will be closed and unable to assist students. Bathroom maintenance, main delivery, sports equipment loans, garbage removal, and other services may be slowed down or cut back, according to the email. Students are requested to make an effort to keep the residences and grounds clean if job action continues. All students should have received the email which pertains to the job action. If you have not received an email or want more information on the progressing job action, visit www.ubc.ca/jobaction.
UBC announced a new scholarship aimed at attracting top doctoral students to enter its forestry program. The Future Forest Fellowship Scholarship is the largest scholarship in the world for forestry students, providing a PhD student with up to $240,000, equal to $60,000 annually for 4 years, to probe into the issues facing BC's forests and related sectors. Funding for the scholarship came through a private foundation. The fellowship will support research focused on British Columbia in the areas of forest products, biotechnology or bioenergy, forest genetics, climate change, and advanced landscape planning, river and landscape ecology, below ground ecology, forest management, or business operations and management. Cindy Prescott, Associate Dean of Graduate Studies and Research in the Faculty of Forestry, said, quote, "The Future Forest Fellowship is a cornerstone in our goal of attracting the world's top forestry students to study and conduct research at UBC. The fellowship provides a fantastic opportunity for an exceptional young scholar to learn from and work with some of the world's top experts in these fields. The Future Forest Fellowship is an important recognition of the vital role that Canada's forests play in the world," end quote. Students beginning a doctoral studies program with the Faculty of Forestry in 2013 are eligible to apply. The recipient of the fellowship will be announced later this fall.
The University of British Columbia Faculty of Law at Allard Hall has launched one of the world's largest prizes dedicated to the international fight against corruption and protecting human rights. The $100,000 prize will be awarded every 2 years to an individual, movement, or organization that has shown exceptional courage and leadership in combating corruption, especially through promoting transparency, accountability, and the rule of law. The prize, named the Allard Prize for International Integrity, was created by Peter A. Allard, a UBC alumnus, as part of his 2011 gift of $11.86 million to UBC's Faculty of Law, the largest gift in the faculty's history, which supported the creation for the faculty's new home, Allard Hall. Nominations for the inaugural prize are now open, and the selection process will occur in the spring of 2013. The inaugural prize is scheduled to be awarded in September 2013.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for more News 101.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing, Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Sunday, October 21st, Socialacious Entertainment and CITR bring you a night of eclectic music at the Media Club, featuring indie rock group Valley Girl, acoustic songwriter Harley Spade, alternative hip-hop acts ACO plus SC, award-winning fiddle punk rocker Alex Randall, and funk soul buster David Morin. Tickets available at the door for $10 or through artists. Come down to the Media Club and kick back 10 days before Halloween with some great local independent music. Show starts at 9 p.m.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. It is now time for another local headline made by our News 101 reporter, Nagin, about a Engineers Without Borders fair at BCIT.
BCIT's own Engineers Without Borders is holding a fair trade fair at the Burnaby campus. The event will run in the Great Hall on October 30th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. A number of fair trade vendors will be showcasing their products at the fair.
We've invited somewhere between 30 and 40 different companies from around Vancouver to come to the fair.
and we've had positive replies from about 7 of them so far. We've only got space for 14, so the event is already confirmed. We've got enough vendors to go ahead with it. A lot of the companies coming are what you would think of as traditional fair trade products, like coffee companies, and there's some tea companies. But we've also invited a guy who imports fair trade soccer balls. And what else? There's fair trade jewelry and fair trade flowers, but they might not be attending. But mostly it'll be coffee and chocolates and snacks and a few arts and crafts, maybe.
The fair trade fair is open to the public. Nagin Resian, CITR 101.9. BCIT Zone Engineers Without Borders is holding a fair trade fair at the Burnaby Camp.
Thank you to Nagin for that headline. It is now time for our weekly weather forecast with our very own Phil Chang. Hi, Phil.
Hello. Thank you so much. Good evening, listeners. No clouds and lots of sunshine is the forecast for this Thanksgiving long weekend. A solid block-like high-pressure cell maintains its presence over the Pacific Ocean as far as our forecast loops extend. 13 degrees should be the norm for temperatures on UBC campus, and with gentle winds as less as 5 kilometers per hour every day, there is virtually no wind chill. Now for Environment Canada's forecast. Today, sunny, high of 18, except 23 inland, UV index of 4 or moderate. Tonight, clear, low of plus 4 with patches of frost. Saturday is going to be sunny, high of 19, 23 inland. And lastly, Sunday, sunny, low of plus 5, high of 18, 22 inland. Great, so there you have it. Enjoy the sunny long weekend, everyone. And I'm Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club for News 101.
Thank you, Phil. It looks like we're going to have a very nice Thanksgiving weekend, so hopefully everyone can get out and enjoy the sunshine a little bit. It is now time for our weekly science segment with our very own Sarah Chow.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. They say the eyes are the windows to your soul, but they can also be a researcher's window to warding off bacteria that can lead to flesh-eating disease, strep throat, diarrhea, staph, and lung infections. Researchers have found that the eyes contains a protein that could potentially lead to inexpensive antimicrobial drugs. This is ideal because this protein is already expressed in our bodies, so they're automatically biocompatible. But what made scientists look for antimicrobial proteins in the eyes in the first place? Well, apparently, the surface of the eye is unlike any other surface on our body. It's free of bacteria. To prove this, they extracted corneal tissue and placed it in lab culture riddled with bacteria. They soon found the bacteria disappeared, showing the tissue had some kind of antimicrobial properties. But what was in the tissue that wiped out the bacteria? Researchers found a protein called cytokeratin 6A, which is a protein that's usually found for maintaining the structure of cells. It's found in cells of the human cornea, skin, hair, and nails. When the cytokeratin 6A gene was silenced in mice, they found the amount of bacteria adhering to their corneas increased by fivefold, which sounds pretty gross. Researchers also found that this protein can also kill bacteria in both water and saline solution, which means cytokeratin 6A can still fight off bacteria, even when tears start to well up in your eyes. But how does it kill bacteria? Well, it has the ability to poke holes in bacterial membranes, making them leak. And if they leak, they can't function, and so the bacteria dies. Because scientists have never looked at keratin proteins as antimicrobial agents, finding a protein like cytokeratin 6A that can fight off bacteria has opened up a new potential target for antimicrobials.
Oh my gosh. This class is so boring. I swear, the hands on my watch are not moving. Will this class ever end?
Does this sound familiar? Well, lucky for you, this type of boredom is only temporary. Chronic boredom can cause some serious accidents, especially if you're doing long-haul driving or tending to a medical emergency. In more severe cases, it can lead to overeating, drug and alcohol abuse, gambling, depression, and anxiety. In fact, boredom can cause such bad health problems, you can literally be bored to death. It's easy to describe what it feels like to be bored, like looking at your clock, staring into space, yawning, but scientifically, what causes boredom? Surprisingly, it's not very well understood. To define boredom, researchers at York University, Guelph, and Waterloo had to draw from various disciplines, such as cognitive neuroscience, social psychology, and clinical psychology. They finally concluded with this definition, quote, boredom is an adverse state of wanting, but being unable to engage in satisfying activity. This arises from the failures in one of the brain's attention networks, end quote. To be more specific, we get bored when we have 1, difficulty paying attention to internal information, like losing our train of thought, 2, difficulty paying attention to external information, like during lectures, 3, are aware that we're bored, so we divert our attention to something else, like the clock, where time stands still, and 4, we blame our environment for our boredom, like, this task is so boring. So how can you overcome being bored? Have goals to look forward to and visualize them. Change your attitude. For example, if you pay attention in class now, you won't have to study later. Be more engaged in lectures by writing down notes instead of just listening. Break out of your daily routine. And of course, stay active. If you think about it, the animal kingdom is full of cheaters. Dogs basically hump anything they come across, and lions have their prides, which usually consist of 1 or 2 males and a bunch of females they all mate with. City-living coyotes, on the other hand, are monogamous until the day they die, which I find pretty romantic. How did researchers figure that out? Well, they genetically sampled 236 coyotes in the Chicago area over 6 years. Apparently, Chicago is a hotspot for urban-dwelling coyotes. Their results showed no evidence of polygamy or even one mate leaving for another. They're just happy where they are. But of course, being loyal is the key to survival in urban areas. Female coyotes produce large litters, up to 19 pups, due to the abundance of food available. And being a single mom in this case is not ideal. Unlike other deadbeat animal dads, male coyotes make sure they chip in to raise their kids because they have a vested interest in those pups, making sure they all survive so his genes will get passed down. They also make sure to protect their mate from other males because raising 19 pups is not a one-person job. Monogamy among urban coyotes actually surprised researchers. Because between 1,000 to 2,000 coyotes live within the vicinity of Chicago. With this many coyotes, you would think there'd be more cheating going on. But researchers found this wasn't the case. But what about in the wild? Why are wild coyotes polygamous? Although this article doesn't address this question, I speculate it's because females in the wild produce less pups due to less food available. Since the male animal instinct is to spread their seed wide and far, they are more likely to be polygamists than their urban counterparts. Well, that's it for this week for Simply Science for CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm Sarah Chow.
Thank you to Sarah Chow for Simply Science. Tune in on Monday or maybe Friday for another segment of Simply Science. Next up, we have our weekly health segment from Dietetics Intuition talking to us about Thanksgiving dinner.
Welcome to your weekly health beat on CITR 101.9 FM.
It's Dietetic Intuition, your source for precise nutrition advice.
What are you going to hear? We'll bust nutrition myths, give tips, do book reviews, as well as interviews, you name it. And now here are your dietetic students, Andrea, Jessica, and Sharon, for this week's segment. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to Dietetics Intuition on this Monday afternoon. And happy Thanksgiving for everyone who celebrates it. Now, every second Monday in October is Thanksgiving. And in Canada, we celebrate Thanksgiving as thanks for a great harvest and a good life. Now, today we're going to talk about some unique twists on traditional Thanksgiving dishes. So here's what a typical Thanksgiving menu may look like. Turkey, gravy, mashed potatoes, stuffing, dinner rolls, a pumpkin pie for dessert. And now I will pass it off to Sharon, who will talk more about new ways to jazz up that regular old Thanksgiving dinner. Sharon?
All right, so here are some twists to these favorites. So let's talk about the turkey and gravy, which are definitely the stars of the Thanksgiving dinner. One year, my cousin made a really juicy 20-pound turkey with grapefruits in it, and I was pretty surprised about that. So I looked this up, and this is actually a great way to get a moist turkey. So you could use a combo of citrus fruits like grapefruit, oranges, and lemon. And there's also a really cool twist on the gravy recipe that I found with the turkey recipe, which includes white wine. So those are the two twists right there, white wine in your gravy and citrus fruits for your turkey. So this recipe will be on our blog, and it's by foodnetwork.com. Now, Brussels sprouts. So there's usually at least like one main vegetable, but I do find that Brussels sprouts tend to be quite traditional. So what I found here was kind of neat. It's basically caramelized Brussels sprouts with cranberries and bacon in it. And as a twist, what I would add would be like toasted walnuts or pecans or slivered almonds would be kind of neat. And that's by that cook who's from Dinner's Impossible. So that's probably a good source there. And I think because it's the holidays, we're not too afraid if you get a little extra bacon in here and there, so don't be too afraid. Now for your mashed potatoes, again, another staple for most hearty meals, there are a couple different options that I came across. So you could have garlic mashed potatoes or add a little cream cheese to it. For a little different twist, but I think something that's quite traditional as well is to have a little bit of sweet potato mixed in there, or even wasabi mashed potatoes for an Asian flair. So those recipes are from homemadesimple.com, and there's another neat thing that I came across for garlic mashed potatoes with eggplant in it. So again, if you want to get a little bit more fiber and vegetables but good flavor, that's another way to go. Now, one of my aunt's favorite, I would say famous recipes, is to have mashed yams. And there's no butter in it or anything, so it's quite healthy. And she chops fresh jalapeno in there, so it has a little kick to it and is kind of a nice complement to everything else, which is usually quite savory on the menu. Now for stuffing, how does cornbread, bacon, leek, and pecan stuffing sound? So I thought cornbread is kind of a different twist that I haven't really seen on many menus. And this is from MarthaStewart.com, so must be great. And I'm actually going to be making that for my Thanksgiving menu, so I might leave a comment on our blog about that. So dinner rolls, again, are usually quite prevalent on these menus. And I found this recipe for, it's called elegant rolls. And basically they can be baked in three different shapes, like a knot, kind of longer, just like the normal round shape. And they're salted on the top. So I thought that was kind of different. And the point is to have just a little twist, because Thanksgiving is something you look forward to, where you can have those traditional dishes. And so just a little twist is kind of what we're looking for. So we're almost to the end here. So we have cranberry sauce, which is very versatile, as it can sometimes replace gravy. But the recipe that will be shared on our blog includes apricots in it. So very seasonal as well. And this will There will also be another one with citrus in there with a little touch of orange and candied ginger. So that might complement the turkey very well if you do the citrus turkey. Okay, now I think the other star of the Thanksgiving dinner is definitely pumpkin pie, something that everyone looks forward to. But have you ever thought of pumpkin ice cream? So you could try mixing canned pumpkin puree and vanilla ice cream with chopped walnuts and refreeze it to make it like your own ice cream, or even warming pumpkin puree on the stovetop with a little bit of cream and just putting that as a dollop alongside your vanilla ice cream would be kind of neat. And then as, you know, fun toppings, you can do a caramel drizzle with toasted walnuts. And if you find crumbled graham crackers anywhere, something to kind of resemble the pie crust, you can drizzle that on top. So it's very decadent. But I did find a really neat recipe from a pastry chef in New York, I believe, that has a full pumpkin ice cream recipe on the blog. So that link will be available as well. So those are just some things to keep in mind, and I hope you give that a try. Now, Lauren's going to talk about what you can do with all the leftovers, because you definitely have some options there and you can be quite creative.
Thanks, Sharon. So usually the first few days after the family feast, you're left with a smorgasbord of leftovers that you have to try to use up quickly over the next few days. Although turkey sandwiches and wraps are one of my personal favorites of all the post-Thanksgiving foods, there are lots of inventive ways that you can use up your leftovers. For example, making mini turkey pot pies using the leftover turkey, mashed potatoes, and gravy, so something along the lines of shepherd's pie, can be a really different way to use up those leftovers. To make it really easy on yourself, just purchase a pre-made pastry shell, and it'll be really quick and easy to put together, throw in the oven, and heat up. You can serve it with the rest of your leftover sides or a fresh salad to mix things up. Another way to use up the turkey is to make soup. Put the turkey bones and leftover pieces that you would otherwise throw out to simmer in water to create a really flavorful broth. If you're sick of turkey for the time being, you can stop here and freeze the stock to use anytime in the future. And if you do want to finish the soup off, put in your leftover meat, your Brussels sprouts, roasted potatoes if you've made them, and any other vegetables you want to throw in there, and just cook it up for another great meal. It's important to note that turkey should only be left in the fridge between 2 to 3 days, so you may want to freeze it ahead of time if you're not planning on eating it. We wish you a great Thanksgiving evening, and hope you check out our site for the links to the recipes that we mentioned here today. Happy Thanksgiving Day, and thanks for talking turkey with us.
Thanks for tuning in again this week.
If you missed us, please go to blogs.ubc.ca/dietetics intuition or follow us on Twitter at CITR Health, and even like us on Facebook at Dietetics Intuition. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
Thank you to Dietetics Intuition for their stories. It is now time for a quick break, but please do stay with us for your provincial and national news on CITR 101.9 FM.
Lost about a Liberty City, burned it to the ground.
CITR 101.9 and Union Events are proud to be showcasing several excellent punk bands at the Vogue Theater this October 18th. They've got the unlimited creative and passionate Less Than Jake. They've got the infectious hyperkinetic Real Big Fish. And to top it off, they're unleashing Flatfoot 56, a band re-energizing the Celtic roots of hardcore punk. Tickets are available online at thevoguetheater.com for $28.50. But don't miss your chance to dance this October 18th at the Vogue Theater. It's going to be sick.
Come Friday at the Cobalt, 917 Main Street, where they aim to please with a reliable lineup of bands, buddy hangouts, and songs your new boyfriend hasn't heard of. With DJs Trevor Risk of Ice Cream Social and Christian Flores of Winnie Cooper, as well as photos by the lovely Lindsay of Lindsay's Diet. $3 Fireballs, $3 Pacific Pilsners. Come Friday, every Friday. It's not just a clever name.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to us on the FM dial at 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. It is now time for your provincial and national news.
The provincial government has stated that the deals it has been signing with major public sector unions will be able to provide raises without a corresponding raise in taxes, but the public has yet to be informed of how these deals will be financed. Recently negotiated deals include those with the BC Nurses Union, which has negotiated a 3% raise, and the BC Government and Service Employees Union, which has negotiated 4% over 2 years. These deals were the first reached under the government's cooperative gains mandate, in which wage increases were drawn from existing budget productivity gains. These gains are being realized through an increase in overall work hours, decreasing the number of overtime hours paid, and implementing a leaner model for operations. The NDP critics have declared that the process must be more transparent so that taxpayers have a better understanding of where their money is going.
The Supreme Court of Canada ruled that it is no longer illegal for HIV carriers to have sex and not inform their partner. The 9-0 ruling included two provisions. A, the partner in question must have a low load of the virus, and B, the partner in question must use a condom. The court based its ruling on two cases, one where a man in Manitoba had sex with 9 women after being diagnosed with HIV, and the second where a Quebec woman didn't warn her sexual partner that she had HIV. The court specified that this change in the law comes on the heels of medical advances in the treatment of the virus, which causes AIDS. The original law was instituted in 1998, and the consequences of failing to inform a sexual partner that you had the virus meant facing charges of aggravated sexual assault. If convicted, this carries a maximum life sentence. This law is still applicable if the offender fails to use a condom or has a higher than allowed load of the HIV virus.
The company at the center of Canada's latest E. coli scare broke its silence Thursday as Agriculture Minister Gary Ritt stared down a firestorm of opposition criticism of one of the largest food recalls in Canadian history. XL Foods Incorporated, which operates the meat plant in Brooks, Alberta, where the contamination first occurred, made its first public comments on the recall since the crisis began in early September. A statement released Thursday read, quote, "We take full responsibility for our plant operations and the food it produces, which is consumed by Canadians from coast to coast. We are doing everything we can to take the lead in an enhanced, comprehensive food safety program for our plant." End quote. Ritz, meanwhile, called a news conference on short notice, his second in as many days, to address what he called misinformation about the E. coli scare. The XL plant has had its license suspended and won't be restored until the minister gets written notice from the Canadian Food Inspection Agency that the plant is safe, Ritz said.
The Canadian economy added 52,100 jobs in September. 44,100 of these were new full-time jobs and 8,000 part-time, defying expectations and supporting the Bank of Canada's argument for an eventual interest rate rise. However, the unemployment rate rose modestly to 7.4% from 7.3% in August as more people participated in the labor market, Statistics Canada said in its release on Friday. The economy has added an average of 21,600 jobs per month in the past 6 months in comparison to the 52,100 in September. Yeah. The median forecast in a survey of analysts was for 10,000 new jobs, and even the most optimistic forecast was only for 28,000 after August's rise of 34,300.
Canada said on Thursday that a $15.1 billion Chinese bid for domestic oil company Nexen Incorporated raised difficult policy questions, but the government gave no sign it would bow to an opposition demand to veto the deal. Speaking hours after the main opposition party demanded a veto on CNOOC Limited's bid, Prime Minister Stephen Harper said the government would look at a range of issues in determining whether the deal, the largest foreign takeover ever launched by a Chinese firm, would be of net benefit to Canada. The deal has also raised rare public signs of unrest among conservative legislators, some of whom fret about the idea of a Chinese state-owned enterprise buying Canadian energy assets. When asked about the bid, Harper told reporters in Ottawa, quote, "This particular transaction raises a range of difficult policy questions, difficult and forward-looking issues. Those things will all be taken into account," end quote.
And those are your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay tuned for your international news.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the commercial drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR.
To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Saturday, October 27th. Union Events presents Alan Stone live in concert with special guests Kingsick and Yuna at the Vogue Theater. Stone mixes elements of pop with soul and gospel into a soul-soothing sound, so don't miss his last Canadian tour stop. Tickets are $20 and can be purchased in advance through Zulu Records or online at unionevents.com or voguetheater.com. Doors open at 7, all ages are welcome.
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Morgan Yee, and you are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia. Now we go to Democracy Now! For some headlines.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on the road in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hundreds of protesters have begun gathering in the Jordanian capital of Amman to call for reforms a day after the country's king attempted to deter the protests by dissolving parliament. King Abdullah had also called for early elections in a bid to dissuade demonstrators from rallying. As many as 50,000 people are expected to join the demonstration called for by the Jordanian wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. Turkey has authorized further military action against Syria as it continued to fire artillery across the border for a second day Thursday in retaliation for a mortar blast that killed five Turkish civilians. Turkish police used tear gas to disperse anti-war protesters near the Turkish parliament, while lawmakers overwhelmingly backed a measure allowing the military to conduct cross-border actions. The Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan said the country was attempting to deter further violence.
Turkey wants peace and only peace in the region, as well as safety. This is our sole concern. We don't want war, and we never would. The consequence of wars in the region, in Iraq and Afghanistan, is obvious. The parliamentary authorization of foreign deployment of Turkish troops is intended solely as a deterrent. As you are aware, one of the most important instruments to prevent clashes is deterrence.
Police in South Africa have shot and killed another striking miner amidst continuing labor unrest. The worker was shot in the stomach with a rubber bullet and died after police moved to disperse protesters gathering near a Rustenburg platinum mine. The killing comes less than 2 months after police shot dead 34 striking miners at the Marikana platinum mine in the country's bloodiest security clash since the end of apartheid. The strike spread across the mine industry this week as striking Toyota workers forced a plant in Durban to close for 4 days. The workers were expected to return to work today after winning a pay raise. Reports have emerged Iran has been attempting to gather support for a plan to end its stalemate with the United States and its allies over the country's alleged nuclear program. Iranian officials have outlined a 9-step plan whereby Iran would end work at one of two uranium enrichment sites in exchange for the easing of sanctions that are devastating its economy. U.S. officials, however, have dismissed the plans as untenable. Protests have erupted this week in Iran amidst a worsening financial crisis that saw the collapse of its currency, the rial. Yemeni officials say a U.S. drone strike has killed 5 people in the southern province of Shabwa. The attack hit 2 vehicles that were said to be carrying militants with links to al-Qaeda. The Pakistani political leader, Imran Khan, has vowed to move forward with a peace march this weekend, aimed at highlighting the impact of U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan's tribal areas. Activists from Britain and the United States, including Code Pink leader Madia Benjamin, are joining the march from Islamabad to South Waziristan, despite concerns over security. presidential candidates in Venezuela held closing rallies Thursday ahead of Sunday's election. President Hugo Chavez is facing challenger Enrique Capriles in what could be the toughest challenge of his 14-year rule. Chavez, who's recovering from recent cancer surgeries, addressed hundreds of thousands of supporters in Caracas.
You all know that there were several times that I was about to die for being faithful to the Venezuelan people. And that is my path. I will not fail you. I will always be faithful to the Venezuelan people.
President Chavez's opponent, Enrique Capriles, held a rally in the Venezuelan state of Lara on Thursday. In his remarks, he addressed Chavez directly, saying it's time for a change.
I want to tell you, your term ends. I thank you infinitely from my heart that you, during this campaign, allowed me to see clearly the route we must take, the route of love, not hate, the route towards light, not darkness, the route of love and commitment to the people, not of insult nor hate.
A U.S. citizen opened fire at a hotel in Israel earlier today, killing an employee before being shot dead by police. The shooter had reportedly been working at the hotel in the resort city of Eilat as part of a program that brings Americans to Israel, but was recently fired from his job. On the campaign trail, President Obama slammed Republican challenger Mitt Romney during appearances in the battleground states of Colorado and Wisconsin. Some had criticized Obama's appearance in the first presidential debate Wednesday night, saying he appeared lackluster compared to a more aggressive Romney. Obama hit back against his opponent during a rally in Denver, accusing Romney of backtracking over tax cuts for the wealthy.
When I got onto the stage, I met this very spirited fellow who claimed to be Mitt Romney. But it couldn't have been Mitt Romney, because the real Mitt Romney has been running around the country for the last year promising $5 trillion in tax cuts that favor the wealthy. The fellow on stage last night said he didn't know anything about that.
Mitt Romney, meanwhile, tried to capitalize on his high marks from the debate as he campaigned in the swing state of Virginia. Some critics noted Obama had failed to ask Romney about his famous 47% comment that nearly half of Americans believe they're victims entitled to government support. During a Fox News appearance Thursday night, Sean Hannity asked Romney how he would have responded if Obama had brought it up.
Well, clearly in a campaign with hundreds, if not thousands, of speeches and question and answer sessions, now and then you're going to say something that doesn't come out right. In this case, I said something that's just completely wrong. And I absolutely believe, however, that my life has shown that I care about 100%. And that's been demonstrated throughout my life. And this whole campaign is about the 100%.
Fast food chain Chipotle has reached a deal with the Florida-based Coalition of Immokalee Workers to improve wages and working conditions for farm workers who pick tomatoes used in its products. Chipotle had previously refused to sign a contract affirming its commitment to the coalition's Fair Food Program, which 10 other companies, including McDonald's and Burger King, have already joined. Thursday's agreement comes a day after coalition member Gerardo Reyes Chavez appeared on Democracy Now! In Denver to discuss its efforts to pressure Chipotle. Dozens of Walmart workers at retail stores in Southern California launched a one-day strike to protest retaliation against employees who have taken a stand over working conditions. On Thursday, hundreds of workers and their supporters rallied in front of a Southern California retail store. The strike follows walkouts at warehouses in California and Illinois that supply Walmart stores. The new head of the World Bank has signaled he's planning to unveil major reforms next week during meetings in Tokyo. On Thursday, Jim Yong Kim said he will push for the World Bank to be able to move more quickly and be held accountable for on-the-ground results. Jin Young Kim helped found Partners in Health with Dr. Paul Farmer and is a former president of Dartmouth College. And a video of a Wisconsin news anchor taking a stand against a viewer who insulted her weight has gone viral. WKBT-TV anchor Jennifer Livingston received an email from a viewer who took issue with what he termed her physical condition, saying, quote, "Surely you don't consider yourself a suitable example for your community's young people." Livingston used the insult to make a statement against bullying.
"The truth is, I am overweight. You could call me fat, and yes, even obese on a doctor's chart. But to the person who wrote me that letter, do you think I don't know that? That your cruel words are pointing out something that I don't see? You don't know me. You are not a friend of mine. You are not a part of my family, and you have admitted that you don't watch this show. So you know nothing about me but what you see on the outside. And I am much more than a number on a scale. To all of the children out there who feel lost, who are struggling with your weight, with the color of your skin, your sexual preference, your disability, even the acne on your face, listen to me right now. Do not let your self-worth be defined by bullies."
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on a 100-city silent majority election 2000.
Thank you to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! For those international headlines. For more international news, we now go to Free Speech Radio News.
In Syria today, protesters marched through the streets of Aleppo, Deraa, Damascus, and other cities and towns. In a video posted online by the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a small group of children marched with other protesters in Idlib. The observatory said at least 40 people were killed throughout the country today, including in the city of Homs, where residents reported shelling and assaults from tanks. One activist in Homs told Al Jazeera that he counted 5 rockets per minute in his neighborhood during the bombardment today. Tensions around the ongoing conflict have risen in the past 48 hours after the Syrian regime killed 5 civilians across the border in Turkey's city of Akakale, and Turkey returned fire. On Thursday, Turkey's parliament authorized the use of force. In response, thousands protested in Istanbul and Ankara last night. One protester, Nevzat Evrim Onal, told The Telegraph that U.S. interests played a role in Turkey's decision.
"We are going through an ugly provocation of war. The Turkish and Syrian people are not enemies. The government is trying to drag us into a war with Syria in compliance with U.S. interests."
Turkey is sheltering nearly 100,000 refugees from Syria. On Thursday, the UN's Security Council condemned the shelling inside Turkey. The council's president for October, Guatemalan Ambassador Gert Rosenthal, called for restraint.
"The members of the Security Council underscored that this incident highlighted the grave impact the crisis in Syria has on the security of its neighbors and on regional peace and stability. The members of the Council demanded that such violations of international law stop immediately and are not repeated."
So far, UN resolutions and peace efforts have failed to stop the bloodshed. This Sunday, voters in Venezuela head to the polls for their presidential election. President Hugo Chavez is seeking a fourth term and faces what is being called the strongest challenge to his presidency so far. Opposition candidate Enrique Capriles has highlighted a crackdown on the media and violence rates in the country. But Chavez still has strong support, especially among residents who have benefited from his broad social programs and those who share his criticism of American influence in the region. For more, we go to Caracas to speak with journalist Virginia Lopez. She's been covering the upcoming election for The Guardian. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, thank you.
You've been speaking to some Chavez supporters at recent rallies. What have they told you about why they're supporting him?
it basically divides into two camps, I'd say, with sort of recurrent themes. Chavez is magnificent at creating an emotional bond with people. So there's, you know, there's a huge contingent of people that have spoken of their undying love and admiration for Chavez. And then on the other hand, there's people that speak of all the support that they've gotten from social programs, what the so-called misiones here, which have benefited people with things primarily that range from education to free housing.
And the misiones are the government-run programs that go into neighborhoods, many of them poor neighborhoods or underserved neighborhoods, with these vital services.
Yes. Like I said, they can range from education. There's also a huge emphasis on health at the diagnostic level, especially. And Misión Vivienda, which is one of the latest. It started off as a response to people who lost their homes with flash floods, and have now handed out, I think it's something close to 300,000 houses, maybe.
You mentioned the emotional bond that many voters feel to Chavez and his presidency. Are there certain primary issues that are motivating voters at this time?
Yes, the main issue, I mean, one of, again, a recurrent theme that we've been listening to as we've followed both candidates in the campaign trail is on the opposition camp, insecurity is a huge issue. Actually, I would say that's an issue that goes across the border. Venezuela has one of the highest murder rates in the world. The other issue is employment and economics. There's been an exchange control for the past 9 years, which has, paralyzed the economic sector for most people here. But like I said, Chavez supporters are feel that there's been a huge difference done at the social level with the misiones.
Well, the main opposition candidate, Enrique Capriles, seems to be closing the gap in some polls, but still trails Chavez. Tell us about him.
He's young. He's 40 years old. He trained as a lawyer. He was elected congressman at the age of 27, and then went on to actually direct the Congress before it was dissolved by Chavez shortly after, in 1999, I want to say. From then on, he became a member of a party called Justice First, which was at the time a new party made up of mainly young people that were dissatisfied with the way politics had been conducted by sort of the status quo political parties. And he was elected then governor of Miranda, which is the second most populous state. So again, you know, he's got a wide track in politics and is quite well trained.
Well, other concerns have to do with the media. The Committee to Protect Journalists said in August that the administration had blocked critical coverage, closed broadcasters, sued reporters for defamation, and harassed journalists who are critical of the Chavez administration. Has this influenced the election at all?
I don't think it's influenced or it will influence the result. I think it's indicative of some of the situations that we face. It's also been a violent campaign. Three people were killed. Three opposition leaders were killed last week. There's an investigation pending on the case, but according to the accusations, they were killed by gunmen in a vehicle that had logos from a state-run PDVSA. It's a situation that should be peaceful. In the past, there's not been political violence during the elections, but many fear that it could turn, or, you know, that there could be some violence because it's so volatile.
Virginia Lopez is a journalist with The Guardian. She joined us from Caracas, Venezuela, where President Hugo Chavez faces a re-election voting on Sunday. Virginia Lopez, thank you for joining us.
Of course. Thank you.
Palestinians in Gaza face arbitrary arrest, detention, torture, and unfair trials, according to findings of a report from Human Rights Watch released today. The report, Abusive System, Criminal Justice in Gaza, documents what it calls extensive violations by Hamas security forces and says courts are failing to protect due process. It notes that since Hamas took control of Gaza in 2007, three men have been executed after confessions that appear to have been obtained under torture. Safiya Ahmed Shrair described to Human Rights Watch how her son, Abdel Karim, was executed by Hamas government firing squad in May 2011 after a military court convicted him of collaboration.
They abducted my son, put him in prison, and tortured him. They executed him. Before they executed him, I didn't get to see my son. They buried him without letting me see him. I'm asking for justice, for the truth to come out, to differentiate the oppressor from the oppressed. My son died oppressed.
The Independent Commission for Human Rights said it had received nearly 150 complaints of torture by Hamas forces in 2011. The group also monitors abuses of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and in August faulted it for failing to hold police accountable after a beating in Ramallah led to at least six protesters being hospitalized. Human Rights Watch attributes much of the abuse of detainees to the political rivalry between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Hamas leadership responded to the report, calling it politicized and one-sided. It said it had opened prisons to rights groups for oversight. Internet freedoms have also come under scrutiny recently following an order from the Hamas-led government to block all pornography-related sites. Hamas contends that such sites conflict with the culture of Gaza that is based on Islam and social traditions. But some Gazans criticize the move, which they say could be used to prevent access to other information. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
The Ministry of Communications will fend Gaza's internet service providers about $300 a day if they don't block pornography sites. While some residents support the rule, others see it as the latest crackdown on personal freedoms. Abir Ayub is a 25-year-old social activist. Abir says that following the decision, she has had troubles accessing news and information websites.
It's up to me, I choose the things I want to watch and I choose the things I don't want to watch. It's not your job to choose for me because God gave me this choice, so he will reward me or punish me at the end.
But university graduate Mu'taz Al-Ajla from Gaza City has no problem with the decision and say some censorship is needed.
Satan is very good at distracting our attentions, and I think no one can guarantee he or she would not attempt to go to such websites. This is better and rather a relief for us.
Thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for today, Friday, October 5th, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email at news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Morgan Yee.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show was produced by Chirag Mahajan. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.